We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
You are looking live at the McNeil and Parkins Show.
Dan McNeil, Danny Parkins.
Hey, give me a cigar.
Opa! Opa, indeed!
How's that Greek chicken working out for you, Mac?
Let me tell you something. Oregano and lemon, great idea as a seasoning for poultry.
It works.
Oh, is that hot? Lots of butter. Oh, man, that is spectacular. Now that I know Mitch hates it when guys eat in the studio and have food in their mouth, I may just do the rest of the show while noshing.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Good. Poke the bear a little bit?
Yeah.
Okay.
Kind of the mindset today.
I believe you.
Yeah.
I can imagine. This hour on The Score brought to you by Vasectomy Clinics of Chicago.
There's a reason for it, too. It's not random. He called me Dan several times today in a text message, and he never calls me Dan unless he thinks something is up.
Oh, serious.
That's not happy, and it's everything is very, very happy today. I just wanted to have a quick visit with him and the big boss, and he's like, Dan, why are you here? Yes, I'm here, Mitchell. I absolutely am here, so... All right, so maybe I'll challenge him a little bit today. Probably not. That's not a good way to respond to him. He's a guy who very, very, very much would hate to hurt because I really, truly like working for Mitch. I always have. He's always been very, very good to me.
Yeah.
Pass me the Dolmatas. Opa!
We still have some Dolmatas left, I hope.
Yeah, they're hiding in the office.
Oh, okay, good. Good. I wanted to be sure. You know, you've missed out on some of the times when food's been around here recently.
I know. That's why I
take care.
That's
of
why
you.
I sort of commandeered this. I can't eat all of this here. I'm happy to share. If you're still
okay.
Hungry, well, you're working now.
I'm working. Yeah. I'm working.
All right, I'll
it.
Do the same with you.
Yeah, it's okay. Yeah, it's good. That's good.
Yes, Peoria Matt, he did spell Dan correctly. Matt is what we call a P1 listener. We are his number one station, and he recognizes Mitch's spelling issues from previous conversations we've had. I love some of the dopey texts that go on. That's about maybe my favorite 4 or 5 minutes of the day, or certainly in the team photo, is after transition, which we usually swipe 5 or 6 items, going through 100 text messages from all the Score listeners responding to all of the topics. I love that interaction and playing with these guys during the timeout before we actually start the show at 1:30-ish.
It's beautiful. Did any of them, what jumped out to you today off the text screen?
One guy wanted to know what album we featured for Jimmy Page's 75th birthday yesterday, and I told him Tanny and I ran the gamut. We did some shredding riffs off of the Les Paul. We also did some sweet, soulful acoustic stuff. One guy wanted to know what the best... What's a better jingle, the boat show or the All Canada show? And I'm going with the old boat show jingle. Yeah, that was a little
the
bit
OG
more,
version.
Yes, yes, the old version of it is a little bit. They've truncated it, right? It's just the boat show. That's all it is now. It used to be come on down to the boat show. The boat show. That tag at the end has more punch, has more kick, if it is preceded by come on down to the, in my humble opinion.
Oh.
Still a damn good punch
Why make it a humble opinion if it is the correct one? I mean, you want to hear the whole jingle. You want to hear
right.
the classic,
don't
not just
tease
the hook.
Me. Right.
Yeah.
You know.
Go all out for your boat show.
Another guy had memories of Olchek telling Spiegel and me years ago when Spiegs asked him something about Pierre Maguire, you know, insinuating that maybe they didn't really love working with him. Eddie said, hey, my phone's breaking up. I got to go. And I was like, good recall. I remember that.
Wow.
I was sitting right across from Matt. Yeah. So those are some of the highlights of my early show today.
Beautiful.
Thank you for asking.
Oh, of course. Tanny, can you believe it's been 20 years? And did you watch The Sopranos while it was on the air, or did you get into it late like I did?
Well, I'm still in it, if technically speaking. You know, I cycle through The Sopranos every holiday season. It's part of my vacation ritual. My parents did not have premium channels in the house back when I was in high school. I was 16 in 99, so we did not have it. So I caught on late. I binged in time to watch season 6B live with the rest of the world. So
okay, cool. So you saw at the height of its popularity, you were there live.
Yes.
Okay. I was in a tough spot there because I had started to get into it watching that, you know, season six is what year is that even coming out?
I mean, the 6B was 2007.
2007. So I'm in college and I'm like, man, I didn't see all of this. Can I go back in time? And then it was trying to like avoid the spoilers. I'm like, okay, I'll just black it out, yeah. And I'll start catching up on
How'd
it.
How'd that work out for you? The most talked about ending in TV history, avoiding spoilers.
Well, that was the thing.
Yeah, it was kind of really ambiguous, though, in a way, so you didn't avoid anything, I suppose. So I guess you got lucky.
A little lucky because of how it happened, but it's like, oh, okay, it'll be a big deal. I'll unplug. I'll try to avoid the conversation, and it'll go away in 48 hours, and this summer I'll just, you know, rip through it and catch up on the whole show. And then it became the biggest pop culture story for, like, 3 months, as I remember it. And it still is being debated to this day how that show ended. Did Tony die? Did he not die?
Yeah, and it's been, what, 11 years now since it's been off the air?
Yeah, yeah. We're going 12 years.
Jeez.
Since the fade to black moment. I have always been in the camp of Tony died. Spoiler alert. At the end of it.
Me too.
You too?
Yes.
Tanny?
I go back and forth all the time because I've watched some interviews with some of the writers and the producers, and although all the signs, I believe, point to the fact that he dies, I don't think it's necessarily the point of the scene and the show. Like, the, you know, the finality of Tony dying, I don't think is really important to the whole storyline. I think it's one of those things where Tony was a guy as a mob boss constantly looking over the shoulder, whether or not he died that night or not. It was kind of that's how he lived his life, and that's the end of it. And I remember seeing an interview with Matthew Weiner, who was a producer for the show, and then he went on to create Mad Men. He believes that the ending was Chase sort of giving an FU to the media and critics of the show as the show was going on. So I think there was some of that to it. Just, I'm taking television away from you. That's how Weiner described it. That's it. No more TV. TV's done. It was sort of like a mic drop for the greatest television show ever made.
Yeah, TJ Quinn just did a big thread that went viral on Twitter ahead of the 20 years, and he was talking about how kind of in that FU from David Chase and how people were talking about the violence of the show, that as the show ended, it stepped up its game with gratuitous violence. And, you know, like Phil Leotardo, it wasn't enough for him to just be shot dead. The car had to run over him in front of his wife with the kids in the car, and the motorcyclist outside of the Bing, and all the things that would happen that felt a little gratuitous, and how the shots in the last scene kept changing from Tony's perspective to the audience's perspective. How I had always interpreted it was they're going back and forth. He sees the members only jacket. He's looking over his shoulder. He chooses the seat in the diner to look at the door because he always has to see who's coming in and out. He's going to live the rest of his life in constant fear. And then it goes black for him because the members only jacket. And earlier right. in the show, they say you probably never even hear it when it comes, when it's him and Bobby. But this most recent theory is that actually the last view that you see is your view. So it's you going out and the gratuitous violence. So nobody gets to see whether or not the violence actually occurs at the end.
Exactly. And I read recently where I didn't notice it until just now. This is why I've seen it like five or six times all the way through. And you notice different things every time you watch it. But the members only guy coming in from Tony's 3 o'clock, which was a big death connector throughout some of the earlier seasons all up until the end. So he's coming in on his 3 o'clock side. I was like, oh, that's very interesting. And then I saw someone say that it could possibly be a dream sequence. The way it's edited, it's kind of like dreamlike, how you jump perspectives all, you know, in the
yeah.
shot. So that's what I love about it. You like no matter what day you're watching it on, how you feel that day, you can totally view it as something different every time, which is why it's so genius.
So it's like the end of Shawshank. Just a dream.
Okay.
Stop it, Shep. Radio programming question regarding the final episode. We had an argument on my show that got kind of heated. It was suggested by probably the biggest fan of the show, I think he was, Ben Finfer, we don't do a review of it until Tuesday's show, so everybody has had the opportunity to go home and watch. Should those who are big fans of The Sopranos not seen the final episode, why in the world would we, based on the way people are watching things these days, Mac? And I said, I understand that, but we're in the opinion distribution business, and it would be a terrible disservice to Sopranos fans who watched the damn highly celebrated final episode and our show to not critique it today. How would you guys weigh in on that?
I'm a big, I hate spoilers and people who intentionally ruin things and like just indiscriminately will share spoilers in a very short period of time after something. I think it's selfish, but put out the disclaimer.
Like just that's what I said we'd do.
Beginning of the segment, especially with something like that that became.
If it's going to go long, every few minutes, just jumping in your car. You don't want to know about the last episode. Don't listen for another 10
minutes. Right.
Yeah, I think we'll only circle back to it one more time today after we do the interview. So like, it's not going to be a running thing. I don't think all day where we talk about it and give spoilers, and we're not going to do like heavy plot stuff today. I don't think we'll probably talk about moments and character performances, things like that. So you know, if you really wanted to see it, like, you know, I feel bad for those people that are in the middle that finally have like committed to watching it 20 years after the fact.
No, you know? I don't feel bad for them at all.
Yeah, statute of limitations has expired, kids.
But the people who intend to watch it, I don't feel bad for those people. But the people that have finally said, okay, I'm committing, and then all of a sudden we're giving out spoilers.
That sucks. But
I didn't feel bad for people who hadn't seen it the day afterward either. If you contend to be a big fan of the show, what the hell else are you doing? I mean, okay, emergencies happen, understood, but come on.
It was a cultural phenomenon. Yes, people who didn't even like the show, I think, checked in. You know what I mean? Like, my wife and parents weren't big fans. They checked in that day to see what was going on.
That's like saving that's the Super Bowl of television in your lifetimes. The final episode of MASH was probably my personal Super Bowl of television. And if I was doing a radio show in the early, and I was, but we weren't doing stuff like that. You talk about it the next day. You don't do a Super Bowl show on Tuesday so people who didn't see the game can catch up Monday night.
I agree. Something that was that big, you got to do it the next day.
You got to do it.
You got to do it when everybody is
talking
about it.
New segment, got to do it.
Got to do it. And so, Tanny, number one for you, for sure, no question, best show ever.
I think it solidified it the most recent time I watched it. It's all the connectivity that David Chase has in there, it by far makes it the greatest show ever. Again, it's just opinion.
Sure.
Not saying definitively this is
your
the best.
Your flavor, and, man. Yeah, it's your favorite. There's no right and wrong.
And your opinion sucks, and I love The Wire. I've seen Breaking Bad, all the great shows, but this by far is my favorite because of the writing and the connectivity from first episode all the way up to the end and the subtlety of it all.
Do you have a favorite show ever because you're such a movie guy?
Yeah, but nothing in the other than True Detective, the only season that mattered. Yes, we should quit acknowledging, which we should just dismiss like there ever was a set. True Detective probably in the last 20 years. More when I was younger, I haven't spent as much time watching television the last 20 years, 25 years, raising kids, trying to chop it up about sports all the time. And when I take my breaks, I take movie breaks.
Yeah, the trailer for season 3 with Mahershala Ali for season 3 True Detective looks good. The trailer looks good.
Well, I'm glad they didn't rush it out like they did season 2. And how you fail with that cast, you got to really work at it, don't you? That was a pretty good cast.
Yeah,
Rachel McAdams, and you had
Colin Farrell.
Colin Farrell worked for me. He was the only character, though, who he was too hard to like. It was hard to like anybody in True Detective season 2.
Yeah.
Terrible.
Yeah,
I didn't like any of them.
No levity, nothing to like. There's no comedic elements. Yeah. And for me, The Wire is number one because it has the connectivity and the great writing that Tanny's talking about, except it's about not that organized crime and mob bosses are not real, but it's about like more reality that touches on everybody. It's an American city. It's a school system. It's politics.
Yep.
It's the drug war. It's cops. So to me, it's like about more everyday stuff and the ability to turn an American city into a drama and make poignant points and arguments and present a side that is now being taught in civics courses at Harvard.
Right.
It's just like that is just a
– right.
That is a television accomplishment that I've never seen replicated. And I love The Sopranos and Breaking Bad and all of those types of dramas. But that's why The Wire is number one to me. But Alan Sepinwall, I've been reading this guy for years. I've never talked to him. I'm really excited. Great job by Shep booking him. He's the TV critic for Rolling Stone. He's an author, wrote a great Breaking Bad book. His book on The Sopranos, The Soprano Sessions, is available now. He's going to join us. We'll hear from Vic Fangio what he had to say about the Bears in his introductory press conference in Denver. We got Brent Musburger, Dave Wanstead, plenty of sports, but Alan Sepinwall is going to tell us some Sopranos stories coming up on The Score.
Once you enter this family, there's no getting out. This family comes before everything else. Everything. Before your wife and your children and your mother and your father. It's a thing of honor. All right, give me a hand. That's St. Peter, my family saint. Now, as that card burns, so may your soul burn in hell if you betray your friends and the family.
The
the great Tony Soprano from arguably the greatest drama in the history of television, The Sopranos. 20 years ago today, the first episode aired. It's our producer Chris Tannehill's favorite show of all time. It's my second favorite show ever. And a man who chronicled it all as a TV critic and now a TV critic for Rolling Stone and an author of The Sopranos Sessions, which I cannot wait to get my hands on. His Breaking Bad book was fantastic. Alan Sepinwall is our guest to talk Sopranos and tell some stories. Alan, thank you very much for the time. How are you doing today?
It's my pleasure to be here, guys.
So tell people about the book and the process of putting this together and trying to encapsulate this culturally iconic television show.
Well, Matt Zellersites and I, who co-wrote the book, we had been the TV critics at the Star-Ledger, which was the newspaper at the end of Tony's driveway. So we had been covering the show exhaustively, right up close, practically embedded with it, at the time it was on. And so we were spectacularly fortunate in that way. And then years later, we moved on to other jobs. We'd written some books together, and we realized the 20th anniversary was coming up. And Matt said we'd need to do a book. And so we did two things. We did recaps of every episode, which required us to rewatch the entire series, which I highly recommend because it really holds up. And then we got David Chase, the show's creator, to agree to sit down to a new series of interviews about it where we went soup to nuts from the beginning to the end that everyone is still arguing about, you know, 12 years later.
So why do you think the continued cultural relevance and power of The Sopranos is still so alive and well in 2019?
Because if you look at television in 2019, it would not remotely resemble itself without The Sopranos. It's the most influential scripted TV show since I Love Lucy. It's been everything, you know, every show you watch on Netflix, any show you stream anywhere, any sort of complicated drama, any serialized comedy, any show with a less than lovable character as the lead, all of these things that we've grown accustomed to in terms of what TV is now, all of those flow out of what The Sopranos did starting 20 years ago today.
And we were just talking about it before you came on, the ending, the great cultural moment of the fade to black, and I'm sure David Chase is tired of answering questions about it. Do you feel like you know what he was trying to do with that ending?
Well, it was really interesting. He hates talking about it, and we went in wondering if we could get him to do it, and we had a plan. We did 7 interviews. We were going to get to it at the 7th, and we still didn't know quite how we would do it. And then midway through the 6th, in answer to a completely unrelated question, he suddenly started talking about it, much to our amazement, and maybe said more than he realized he was saying. And then once we called him on that, he cursed us out, and we laughed about it, and then we talked about it for 45 minutes. And at the end of it, I still couldn't necessarily tell you what happened, but I can tell you what it meant, and ultimately I think that's the more important thing.
Do you believe it was intended to be a middle finger at the critics?
No, not at all.
Okay, good, because that would be a middle finger toward the fans of the show.
Yeah, no, and like Chase has always had sort of mixed, a complicated relationship with the audience, because I think sometimes they embrace Tony and the others more than he thought they would or wanted them to, but ultimately he loves people who love the show, and he would not have done that. He would defy expectations, but he wouldn't do it in sort of a mean-spirited way.
Alan Sepinwall, TV critic for Rolling Stone, author of The Sopranos Sessions, is our guest. This is the 20th anniversary of the airing of the first episode. So is that something you got to save to read the book, or like, what can you tell us about what he meant by it?
Well, what happened was we were talking about something else, and then he says, about general plans for the end of the series. And he says, well, I had that death scene in mind about 2 years before. And as soon as Matt called him out on using the phrase death scene, again, he got upset, but then he started talking and he explained death scene actually referred to a completely different ending that he didn't do, where Tony was apparently going to get killed, you know, going to a meeting with Johnny Sack. But the idea is more that the scene is about death. Rather, maybe he dies, maybe he doesn't, maybe Meadow dies, maybe, you know, somebody else, maybe the audience dies. But it's about the sort of the fragility of mortality and this idea that we are all here on borrowed time, and what are we going to do with that borrowed time, and how will we feel if it suddenly gets pulled away from us like that? So the whole scene, you know, including Meadow parallel parking forever, is there to make you feel that sense of fear and dread and the idea that it could happen to you just like that.
Obviously, you're not able to talk to James Gandolfini now because he's passed, and it was
going to be a good book there.
It would be a hell of a get, but it was a tour de force performance, and it changed scripted drama on television so much, but it also famously took a toll on him. What types of stories can you tell us about the toll it took on James Gandolfini to get into the role of Tony Soprano.
Well, I mean, it's even going back to the audition. Like Chase told us these stories about how Jim showed up. You know, he was kind of out of sorts to begin with. He comes in, he's ready to go, and then he just gets up, starts pacing around, says, "You know what? My mother just died, or my aunt just died. I forget what it was. I gotta go. Let me come back another time." And he leaves, and it turned out his aunt had not died. He had just made that up. But there was just something about him that was really obviously magnetic to Chase, and you could see it in the performance. But like, there's actors who can turn it on and off like a light switch. Edie Falco was like that. She could do these raw moments and then a second later be telling a joke about something that her sister said. Gandolfini, like, being Tony Soprano took a toll. It was hard. People told stories about how, he wanted to quit a bunch of times. There was one time he just disappeared altogether for a few days until I think he turned up in Brooklyn. But, it was hard on him, but we were rewarded with the greatest performance in TV history.
And you believe that? Single greatest performance in TV history?
Yeah, I used to think it was more like a Mount Rushmore situation with him and Bryan Cranston and Jon Hamm and somebody else. And then I rewatched the show to do the book, and no, he gets his own mountain. That's how great he was.
Wow. That's incredible. And did he appreciate it after it was over, Gandolfini?
I think he appreciated it more because he didn't have to do it anymore. But the thing is, Jim was a really shy guy, which you wouldn't necessarily expect. He didn't like getting attention. He hated doing interviews. He only did two or three of them in his entire career, one of which Matt did, which is reprinted in the back of the book. He just sort of didn't – he liked acting, but he didn't like – the celebrity that came with acting. It was a really complicated thing for him, and not in that sort of pretentious, smug way. You will sometimes hear, he genuinely had some social anxiety disorder going on.
Yeah, I had several friends who had the opportunity to spend a little time with him, and they said he was just an absolutely wonderful, gentle man. Anything but what you would expect.
Yes, and he could be volatile, too, and he had his demons. But at root, he was a sort of very kind and gentle guy. And Matt moderated a reunion of the entire surviving cast and crew last night as part of the Sopranos Film Festival he's doing in New York. And Annabella Shior was there, played Gloria Trillo, and she talked about how when they would do sort of either sex scenes or violent scenes, Jim would always make sure to tell her, "I'm going to put my hand here now. Now I'm going to put my hand here. Is that okay?" And she said, "That's rare. That very rarely happens with another actor, but he was always looking out for people."
We're talking to the television critic Alan Sepinwall and the author of The Sopranos Sessions, which is available now. You said you were the critic for the Newark Star-Ledger. I've read a lot about The Wire, which is my favorite show, and it was received differently, and it was a complicated relationship in Baltimore. How does Newark and Jersey receive the Sopranos then and now?
It was a complicated relationship then, but much less so, I think, than The Wire in Baltimore had. There were a lot of people who were upset, whether they were New Jerseyans or Italian-Americans or both, who felt that the show was defamatory, but I think they were very heavily outweighed by the people who were just excited to see the state. I grew up in New Jersey, one town over from where Tony lived, so all of these places he went to, I'd been to, When Carmela says, "I'm going to go buy AJ socks at the Sports Authority," I knew exactly which Sports Authority she was talking about. When Tony Blundetto was going to open his massage parlor, it was in the space where my favorite bookstore growing up was. So, there was a lot of that going on and a lot of weird Jersey pride, because all mob stories until then, they were about the New York mob, and this is a show that begins with a guy driving westward out of the Lincoln Tunnel.
Again, Alan, my producer, Chris Tannehill, it is his favorite show of all time. He already has your book, so he's ahead of me. So go ahead, Tanny.
Thanks, Alan, for joining us today. I got the book yesterday, started diving in before bed. Really enjoyed so far. I was wondering, when I don't know how we're going to consume TV in, 10 years, let alone 20, but, when people look back at television, do you think they'll see the college episode where Tony murders Fabian Petrullio? Do you think they're going to look at that moment and see maybe that could be the most important moment in television history?
It's one of the most important moments in television history. Whether it will continue to be, I don't know, because I did, for Rolling Stone, a list of my 10 favorite Sopranos episodes a while back, and number one I put college, and I had this weird reaction from some of my younger readers who said, obviously it's a great episode, but it doesn't feel as special to us because we came to it after we had grown up watching Breaking Bad and all these other anti-hero shows where the main character, it was not a shock that the main character would kill a guy in cold blood the way Tony does with Febby. But, if you were there at the time, that was the seismic moment, because the first few episodes, you know, it got mixed reviews, mostly positive. Not a lot of people were talking about it. And the Monday morning after college aired, it suddenly, that's when it exploded.
Well, Alan, great stuff. And now they're making a prequel movie. What do you know about the movie?
All right, so it's called The Many Saints of Newark. The name comes from Moltisanti. This is going to be about Christopher's father, Dickie, played by, I think, Alessandro Nivola. And it's going to be set in the late 1960s in Newark. It's going to deal with the Newark riots, about their complicated relationships between Italians and blacks, Italians and WASPs. Knowing Chase, I can't imagine he would do this unless it seemed like a really good idea, because he is so protective of the legacy of The Sopranos that it wouldn't be a cash-in. He doesn't need the money. He doesn't need the attention. He would only do it if he felt like it was a really good story. That doesn't guarantee that it will be, but I'm more optimistic about this than I am about a lot of the revivals that we've seen in movies and TV the last few years.
Alan Sepinwall, TV critic at Rolling Stone, his book, Sopranos Sessions, is available now. Alan, I've been reading you for years. Always wanted to have you on the show. Thank you very much for the time. Maybe we'll do it again with the finale of Game of Thrones.
Guys, my absolute pleasure. Anytime.
Thank you, Alan. Take care.
Thank you. That's Alan Sepinwall from originally the Newark Star-Ledger and now Rolling Stone. The segment brought to you by Exergen Temporal Scanner Thermometer. Cold and flu season is around the corner, and people with conditions like heart disease, asthma, and cancer are especially at risk. Use the thermometer that you and your family can trust, the Exergen Temporal Scanner. Its accuracy is backed by more than 70 clinical studies, and it's the leading thermometer used in hospitals. Top of the hour. We'll step aside for just a second. We'll get Tanny's open and we'll get the show rolling. It's McNeil and Parkins on The Score.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.